Who doesn't love a campy horror flick with a message? Dear Camp 86 is coming to select theaters nationwide on May 31st. The film follows six knuckleheads from Detroit who travel up north for the annual tradition of deer hunting, but something horrific has been awakened and the hunters become the hunted as an ancient spirit seeks vengeance for the death of a Native American girl. Let the fun, beer, gore, and revenge begin. Visit www.deercamp86.com to find showtimes near you. And before we start the episode, I also got to tell you a little bit about our overlords at Fangoria. That's right. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. The magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door four times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including your intrepid KingCast hosts. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, and you damn well should, you will need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And guess what? If you use the code KingCast at checkout, you will save a whopping astronomical, massive 25% off of your subscription.
Very well said, Eric. And now, let's get on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Red Rum!
Circle! You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
And I'm Scott Wampler.
And we are your hosts. I'm going to cut right to the chase. We have a great lineup for you guys this week. Joining us is the director and the star of the recent The First Omen, which ended up being a ripper of a horror movie in its own right. I know I didn't think a prequel to the Richard Donner classic was going to be this elegantly grotesque. And like many horror fans, I walked out of the theater shocked at just how damn good it is. So I'm really excited to talk to these folks here. For those that miss it in theaters, The First Omen gets its digital release May 28th. We'll talk a little bit about that and a little bit about one of the most influential Stephen King adaptations of all time. Of course, when I say that, I mean the It miniseries that scarred a generation. Tim Curry's Pennywise, enough said. We'll get into all that and more very soon. But first, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Arkasha Stevenson and Nell Tiger Free to the KingCast.
Woo!
Hello!
Hello!
The exact same way. That was really weird.
Y'all have been doing too many interviews together.
We formed into one being.
So, my first question for you in regards to The First Omen is, throughout my movie-going history, I've noticed that every once in a while, two studios will put out very similar movies, you know, like Armageddon, Deep Impact, or Volcano and Dante's Peak. When you were making this, did you have any idea that there was also another nun horror movie headed our way with Immaculate?
Was there?
Well, yeah.
Good answer.
Yeah, it's interesting because when we were in editing, we heard that there was another production shooting in Rome about nuns, but we had no idea really what it was about.
This isn't Sister Act 4.
Yeah, we were
plot twist. We were actually making Sister Act 4.
Well, yeah. Both the movies are great. That's the good news. Usually, like, one's way better than the other, but I really enjoyed both of these movies. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, an Omen prequel was, like, absolutely not something that had even ever occurred to me, that someone might make that after all these years. You know, the originals is decades old. What made you want to get involved with this franchise?
Well, I mean, for me, the thing that was cool about our movie is that, you know, we had The Omen behind us as a title, and it's such an iconic franchise. And, you know, it had, you know, decades and decades of very loyal fans, two of them being Karsh and I. So when I, and, you know, naturally, you know, one could be hesitant to think that The Omen prequel, and I'm quoting somebody else here, but fucks as hard as ours does. And that's, you know, when I read it, I thought it was so expertly written. I mean, hardly anything changed from the draft I read to what we ended up shooting. having Kosh at the helm, you know, a divine feminine director. And she had, and she, you know, meeting her and the connection that we had right off the bat, I was just down. I was so ready and so excited. And, you know, it's a reawaken this sleeping giant of horror.
Yeah.
Do it for the ladies, you know? Yeah.
That's not a wrong term. This movie does fuck. It is like, it shows right up front. It's just like, guess what? No, we're a real horror movie. We're not like, you know, a watered down, you know, generic
dicking around,
you know, yeah, screwing around PG-13. Not that there's anything wrong. There can be great PG-13 horror movies. But, you know, when people associate a prequel to a long existing and well-respected franchise coming in, the bar to clear is pretty high with the title, but also considering what's kind of come out in the past with these kind of things, it's not something that a lot of audiences go in expecting like the best. And what I loved about your movie was that this is a, I grew up on movies of the 70s. I'm an 80s kid, but I grew up watching this particular era for the genre, right? So you have like, I'm thinking like, you know, the Italian horror of the era, the Argentos and Fulcis and whatnot. And this one struck me as being very much in vein of like an early Argento giallo, you know, where it's not something that's as crazy as Argento would like grow to do, but it's in terms of like, oh, it's not all bright lights everywhere, and you know what I mean, where it's not flashy, it's just there to really kind of get under your skin and fuck you up. And I really, really appreciated that somebody is still trying to make movies like that within the studio system these days. So
yeah,
apologies for the long-winded way around to essentially go, how the hell did you make a real horror movie in the studio system these days, is kind of what I'm going for.
Yeah
Well, I think we were kind of, I mean, It's interesting. I appreciate you saying that. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, this movie is about female body autonomy. And I think what was really exciting was that the studio was very open and willing and supportive about, you know, talking about that. And I think that unfortunately, it's really rare to have women telling stories about their own bodies. It's usually men. And kind of fetishizing the whole subject. So it's really, you know, I'm very grateful to the studio for being, you know, open and trusting to let us explore body horror from a female perspective. And I think just because that is kind of uncharted territory, that they were willing to explore with us and really push boundaries.
Right. Now your character goes through it a little bit in this movie. I had a lot of friends who have acted in horror, and they say that it, like, to the person, even as much as they love the genre, they say it gets really tough to stay in that headspace for that long and kind of hold that feeling. Did you have a similar experience, you know, kind of with your role here?
I think that I was so energized by the role and by the script and like by everybody involved. I mean, I was just delighted by the fact that it was, you know, like a female-driven horror, and that the protagonist, you know, wasn't sexualized and right, in that manner, and it was just, you know, an exploration of female bodies, like devoid of the sexual gaze, which was so exciting to me. And like, it was a very physically taxing role and emotionally taxing role, but you know, having Kasha there as like my safety net, like my crutch, you know, was so helpful to me, and you know, and it was so helpful to help me code switch and come back to reality and you know, be Nell again in between being Margaret. So yeah, I mean, it was just, it felt like a very empowering thing to perform, and like an empowering thing to be a part of, and I just yeah, I mean, I get hyped up talking about it, because it was such a, you know, an incredible experience for me. And I just felt like, you know, the more taxing the things got that I had to do, the stronger I felt. So, yeah. It was one hell of a ride.
Really just a beacon of energy for all of us. And I think that just because you were going through it and going through it so deeply and fearlessly, that nobody else had any excuse to complain about anything. So it really energized the whole crew.
Love you.
Well, yeah. The movie's great. We definitely recommend that people check it out. And I will, again, remind everyone that the digital release is on May 28th, hits Hulu on May 30th, and will hit DVD and Blu-ray on July 30th. Definitely check this one out if you didn't catch it in theaters. I suppose we should, ask you your Stephen King origin stories. When did you first become aware of our show's namesake?
My first experience was the original It with Mr. Tim Curry, the miniseries from the 80s. That was my first toe dip into the wonderful world of Mr. King. What about you, Cash Money?
Yeah. There was two films that were very influential in my childhood, and that was Splash and Carrie.
Splash. Now that's a crossover I want to see.
And I'll leave you there without an explanation. Goodbye. But you know, depending on the light, my mom growing up looked a lot like Daryl Hannah or Sissy Spacek. Mm. And so I, you know, during Carrie, especially during the prom scene, I would hug the TV and say, "Mama."
Oh my God. Well, better than when Piper Laurie was on screen.
Yeah. So, I did the same thing with Tim Curry.
He's a real force to be reckoned with in this miniseries. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's I don't know. I think that was probably I saw this when it aired, originally. And I think that, you know, I was a kid and it scared the bejesus out of me, but yes, I think that might have been my introduction to Tim Curry. I'm not sure that I had seen him in anything else before.
Not
this.
Rocky Horror, like the rest of us.
Well, I was like
Blooded Americans,
8 or 9. Like, yeah. I had not gotten around to Rocky Horror yet. You know, it was, and it was kind of unusual for my parents to be. They were pretty permissive, but this thing was scary as hell, and I think that they probably assumed, like a lot of people did, that well, it's on broadcast television. How scary could it possibly be? Oh, pretty fucking scary.
Mm-hmm. Pretty fucking scary. Yeah. I mean, it terrified me, petrified me.
Right. Yeah. No, Nell, I think I saw an interview with you where you were talking about the clothesline scene in particular with.
Yes.
Yeah. Right at that opens the fucking thing, by the way. So this is the opening night. Like there's this, you know, kid singing Itsy Bitsy Spider going around, you know, whatever. You're like, what's this? What's going on here now? And then Tim Curry, like you see flashes of him in between flapping sheets. Yeah. It really is a horror story. And that's without any effects. You know, that's just Tim Curry glowering at you from behind a flapping sheet, and that's all you need to go, okay, this thing's gonna give nightmares to an entire generation of children right now.
Yeah. Oh my God, absolutely. I mean, those moments where, you know, it's just this wall of a white sheet, and it's billowing so elegantly and so it's like, you know, almost romantic, and then it comes up and grabs you by the balls, and it's just Tim Curry. And even, you know what, I found the clown scarier when he's not, like, you know, baring his animal teeth. It's like just the clown as he is. It's like there's something more terrifying to me, like a grown man dressed as a clown walking around and talking to children, than even like if it's some sort of otherworldly creature. And I think that's why it felt so terrifying, because it felt like you could just see a crazed man dressed in this way walking around. You know, it felt like it wasn't too far out of reach.
And you do see that.
Me and Karsh were just talking about. There's a bit of a clown renaissance going on at the moment.
Excuse me, where? I need to avoid these places.
In this room. That's right. Oh. Now, like, making us away. No,
unfortunately, this is audio only.
Yeah. Note to self, do not hang out with Nell and Arkasha and their clown friends.
Lots of people have made that note. But yeah, no, there's like clowns appearing on highways and stuff, and some of them were committing crimes and like heinous acts, and it was very recent, and it's like instilled a fear in me that
it's also just like, you will forever think of John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah.
It's a strange mix of Tim Curry and John Wayne Gacy. That feels so blasphemous to say. Or
Sorry, that was awful. I should not have done that. That was terrifying. That's terrifying.
The Tim Curry minus the John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah, minus that.
I totally agree with that one. Yeah.
So were y'all both horror fans as kids?
Yeah. Yeah. You just, see how he said that was such, like a deep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of why we are the way we are.
Sure. Well, what other like horror films were key to your horror diet when you were growing up?
Yeah. Well, this might sound like a really trite answer, but mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty solid one, which is the Exorcist.
And, oh, for sure.
Yeah. Mm. And A&E used to have a double feature on Valentine's Day of The Shining and The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching those, I think I was around 7, and I didn't know what genre was, and I didn't know what a horror film was. And I was still kind of around this age where I couldn't totally comprehend that what I was watching on TV was make-believe.
Yeah.
Right.
And so I just remember watching these very dramatic stories about families going through some really tough stuff. Mm. And then later in life, you're like, oh no, that is a horror movie. And that is supernatural, you know? But it was interesting being introduced to the horror genre before you even have,
you like can of what it is. Yeah, yeah.
Contextualize it like that. So
that was a better word. Should I let you finish?
No, I didn't. Help me.
There's something about kids. Kids are attracted to things that are scary. Even the ones that are the most scared, they're still attracted and enticed by it. You know, I have sure. some of my most fond memories and my earliest memories are being terrified at watching something. I remember, right. you know, sneaking down, you know, downstairs and peeking over the couch as my mom was watching, you know, something scary on TV.
Yeah.
And being able to feel like I was being dangerous because she didn't know I was there, you know, sneaking in this forbidden thing.
Doing that.
What?
No, wait, where does fire come into play?
All right, yeah, dead serious. I had my friend over and we were watching a movie upstairs in my room. And I used to melt Harry Potter. I used to melt butter on the stove to pour over my popcorn.
Okay.
And I had butter on the stove that I was melting and my parents were in the other room watching. It's not a horror film, but it was wildly inappropriate for my age group. They were watching Kick-Ass. Do you guys remember me?
Yes.
And I remember being so transfixed, like creeping around the living room door and watching the movie that I forgot about the butter on the stove. And when I came back into the kitchen, there was like these like 3 foot high flames coming out of the pan. And so I didn't know what to do. So I picked up the flaming pan, put it in the sink and put water on it, which then created an explosion.
Yep.
And there was this just like this white light filled my kitchen. Like it was like a lightning flash in my kitchen. And like my eyebrows were singed and like the whole top of the ceiling was covered in soot. And my parents came in and I was just like this soot covered child standing
like a chimney sweep.
Literally holding this pan of butter. And they later realized it's because I would snuck in and watch the movie. So right. Yeah, that was a bit of a derailment there, but never leave butter unattended, kids.
The unattended consequences of of watching inappropriate movies.
My eyebrows aren't real to this day.
Yeah, you got them tattooed on. Yeah,
because this is audio only, I've actually peeled them off.
We'll just have to take your word for it. But there's something to be said about kind of Stephen King's genius in structuring it in particular around kids, specifically because kids are drawn to genre, and I think that whether he intended it or not, like it, I believe, is always going to be a story that will be embraced by every generation that reads it, right? Because they're always going to have that entry point in with the Losers Club, with the kids. Everybody relates to those kids. Even as a kid in the 80s, you know, reading this, and I related to these kids who were, you know, there are 50s kids in the book, right? And just as I've seen with the recent remake, the Andy Muschietti movies, you know, kids of today are now embracing and feeling the same, you know, thing as the, you know, kids depicted in the movie, which are from the 80s, right? I think we're going to see that cycle go, you know, for decades and generations. And I think it all kind of roots itself into the fact that kids are drawn to horror, and the young generation, while either reading the book or watching, you know, the old movies and miniseries or whatever, they're always going to relate to this. Is that something you guys think I might be reading too much into, or do you think that I'm onto something there?
No, I mean,
well, I have to tell you guys something.
Oh, caution.
I have not seen or read it.
Really? Ooh.
Yeah. Oh my goodness gracious me.
I know.
So I'll answer that one then.
But my attraction to Tim Curry is pure.
It's right.
It's pure, yes.
It's Puri, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like kids are naturally going to resonate with movies that they can relate to. And, you know, the Losers Club is such a relatable thing. I mean, I feel like even the cool kids probably felt a little bit like they were in the Losers Club. At least that's what I tell myself at night. But, but you know, and I think watching a horror film and having, you know, the central story be about friendship really is what it is about for me. And it's like these kids, you know, Tim Curry, the clown, isn't the only horror in the movie, you know. School is part of the horror in the movie. Her father is part of the horror in the movie. The bullies are part of the horror in the movie. So it's like relating real world horror and like real world fears that kids have. And then also translating them into a supernatural element. And I think that's why it's so relatable. I mean, at the end, the kids, you know, kill him with a slingshot. I don't think it gets more kids club than that, you know? Right. And I just think that's probably why I was so drawn to it as a child. It was a movie for the misfit toys. And I think, I think that as a nuance and as a color in horror is always a nice thing. I feel like that sometimes people are so attracted to horror because it can start in like a picturesque place, you know, like the original It, apart from obviously the washing line scene, but it feels like it can feel a bit like a John Hughes movie with all these kids banding together. It's like, what if the Breakfast Club was hunted down by a killer clown?
I assume you haven't seen the new version either, Arkasha, right?
I have not. Yeah.
Right on. No, Nell, have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
How do you feel about the new version of It versus the miniseries version?
I mean, I think it's a modernized version. It's, you know, there's you know, elements like CGI come into play very heavily in the new version. And, you know, it's It of the 2020s, and it's always going to feel different, you know? Nostalgia plays such a big role in why we kind of idolize these films of the past. And why, you know, everything was better back then and everything was done. Do you know what I mean? It's like they have this kind of warm, hazy glow of the past. And that's what connects people to them a lot of the time. But, you know, it was a modernized retelling of it. And I think everybody did a great job in the movie. I actually really enjoyed the movies. It didn't evoke the same feeling in me that, you know, the original did. But I think that's a hard thing to do. But, yeah, I mean, going back and reimagining horror films from the past, what crazy kids would do that? Certainly not us.
I think the new, I love the first one. The second one I'm a little iffier on. I think that ending, well, it really it's like the structure of the entire movie. It seems a little strange to me. You know, it's got kind of a video game feel where they're like, you know, all right, we're all going to meet at this house, and now you're going to go on a mission, and now you're going to go on a mission, and like wash, rinse, repeat, and then that ending just goes on a little too long, like
when he's like the giant
crab spider thing,
yeah. I mean, the way they did that in the original was obviously with practical effects, and you know, it was ridiculous in the original too, but you can look back on it fondly with like a warm kind of nostalgia towards it. But I think trying to you know, from the book and then trying to bring that into real life and make it something that isn't farcical, and I feel like the new It's were primarily a comedy, to be honest with you. I felt like they were very comedic, and that was valued a lot in the new movies. So like at the end, you know, when he is that giant space spider thing, it does have, I feel like they were leaning into the satirical element.
The absurdity,
I hope so.
yeah. I mean, it's, I think that there's a lot to it as well, because in the book, like, everybody kind of gave the book shit for, like, having, like, after all this, he was just a fucking spider or whatever. but like, when you read the book, even in the book, it says, like, listen, this isn't exactly what this thing is, but, like, essentially this is the image that the brain is showing you, because if you saw its true face, you would go insane, which is very Lovecraftian.
Which is cool.
But how the hell do you translate that to screen? Yeah. You know, you can't do that. And I think that, like, no matter what, you're never going to get that full, like, the metaphysical horror of what this entity is ever on the screen, which is probably why you're pointing out that, like, Tim Curry just being himself in the clown makeup is the scariest part. Like, there's something that we can contextualize with it, which, you know, for a book that's all about facing your fear, and that's, you know, part of growing up, it's a coming of age story, really, and how you do that by facing your own fears, you know, I think that it's important for people to relate to whatever they're afraid of. So I think that that's, you know, the reason why either Bill Skarsgård just being a complete, you know, lunatic, you know, with his wandering eye and everything, is so much scarier than the CGI version of the character, and the same reason why Tim Curry's is so much scarier when he's just the guy, you know,
and the guy in the comic space makeup. Spider.
Yeah.
Kosh is listening to us like, what the fuck is this?
we're punking you.
He's like, what do you mean? There's a giant
this doesn't actually exist
in this movie.
Now, since Arkasha, do you have a favorite King thing? So it doesn't feel like we're just only focusing on Nell's favorite. Do you have a favorite King thing? Would it be something like Carrie, because of the relationship that you have with
your television mom?
Television mom. Sissy.
Yeah. No, I mean, I loved Carrie. I'm a big De Palma fan. And this film, so I think I discovered Carrie through De Palma, obviously, through like a De Palma marathon. And so I think there's actually a lot of strange parallels to the Omen, I feel like, with Carrie, and just kind of the themes of like repressed female power.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was very exciting as a child, I feel like. Yeah.
Karin Kusama came on the show and she talked about Carrie and how essentially she was saying how she has to wrestle with the fact that it's a story written by a man, adapted by a man, and then directed by a man that somehow she feels is one of the most, like, cornerstones of feminist cinema, you know, and that's something that she has to, like, grapple with a little bit. Is that something that you kind of felt as you kind of, you know? Yeah.
The opening scene is still filled with tits. Like, the opening scene is still just women slow-mo showering naked.
Yes.
Let's be real.
The male gaze is all over that movie.
Is all over that movie too.
Yeah. De Palma can't help but be horny. I mean, that's his thing.
Sorry, carry on. You take that.
I
had to chime in with
opening
that
of De Palma is just like, you know, breasts or beaver shot.
Breasts or vagina.
Yep.
Like today.
I wonder if they got an NC-17.
They didn't.
They didn't.
Research on that film.
Oh my god, because it was sexualized.
But no, I think it's interesting because, De Palma hypersexualizes women, and then whether or not it was intended or it is just commentary by way of time, is that you have a director who's hypersexualizing all these women around Carrie, and Carrie is the one who's being told that her body and her body's natural functions are horrific and disgusting. And so it actually, you know, now with time, it actually, if it were self-aware, would be even more brilliant.
Yeah.
And if it's not self-aware at this point, who cares? Because it's saying something, you know?
Yeah.
And then you read that Stephen King had a really hard time writing Carrie because he felt really uncomfortable writing this POV and the subject matter. And his wife was actually like, no, you're onto something. Keep going. It's okay.
Right.
So it is a very, it's confronting and conflicting to talk about it. But I think whether
whether it meant to or not, it came out as like this truly feminist horror film.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, all that stuff is there. I mean, it's so very clear. And part of the charm of that movie, I think, is that kind of conflicting feeling, like because when we talk about the male gaze at the beginning of Carrie, it's not like, oh, it's just because there's nudity. It's like he films Sissy Spacek getting her period like it's a 70s softcore porn, right? I mean, he's shooting it sensually. He's got the milky haze on the lens, you know, it's the water slow motion dripping down her thigh. I mean, it's a very sensual scene. That's definitely not, you know, just, you know, Porky style, hey, there's boobs, somebody's taking a shower, right?
Yeah.
But part of the... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, not to cut you off there, but it's like centralizing and sexualizing something that's deeply not sexual at all.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and that's not specific to Carrie. He starts every single one of his films like that and sexualizes or you could say shoots it very sensually.
Yeah.
You know, women's breasts, all of this, you know? It's almost... it's just a natural byproduct of it being a De Palma film. So that being that, I think it almost, I don't think there is intentional commentary. You know, bless you for trying, but I don't think that,
But it is a movie that is like, it's playing with itself. Like the tone goes from deadly serious to like almost Looney Tunes funny. Like there's that whole sequence that's played in fast forward when the dudes are getting like dressed in their tuxes for prom or whatever. And they literally have the, you know, fast forward sound as they're going through the scene, which should not exist in a horror movie. Like, you know, but that it somehow works in there. That's what's interesting, I think, about De Palma is that he's always fucking with tone and perspective and whatnot. And also very mad horny and also very feminist at the same time. So who, you know.
you mentioned earlier, like made like an offhand comment about, I wonder if they got an NC-17. And I wanted to ask you about that because I understand that the first Omen, you had to go back and forth with the ratings board, like what, 5 times to avoid an NC-17?
Yeah, it took 5 times. And it's interesting because you have to kind of sniff out on your own and do your own detective work about what it is that's getting you that NC-17 rating.
They didn't tell you like specifically, like it's this scene or? Like...
No, they don't. You really have to kind of intuit what they're thinking and feeling, which is always fun.
It's always fun.
Yeah. And never terribly time consuming at all. but it did come down to one shot. And spoiler alert, it was not the jackal penis that was ejaculating. And it was the frontal vagina, but it was the moments right before the hand emerges.
Right.
Uh-huh.
They wanted us to cut, you know, we could use that profile shot of the skin kind of tearing and stretching, but we couldn't show the frontal shot unless the vagina was being violated.
What?
Yeah.
They just didn't want to see a normal one on screen. It had to have something happening to it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Mel brings up that commentary in itself.
Proves the point of the movie.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. You're either, you know, used to seeing a vagina with, you know,
slow mo in the shower.
Yeah, with a black with the milky lighting. Yeah. or a woman getting torn apart. And anything that is neither of those is very foreign, I think, to audiences and, you know, obscene to certain ratings boards. But that's the point of the movie, is to get imagery on screen.
I'm astounded to learn that they do not give you specific notes. That seems like the absolute wrong way to go about that process.
Ooh, a fun little treasure hunt.
Yeah. It's, and then eventually, like if the process starts to get dragged out as ours was, they'll start to say like, oh, it's somewhere around here. You know, we just kind of, and you're like, okay. But it's such a subjective thing. Like what I find is offensive, you might not find offensive, you know, but it does start to get like when we realized that it wasn't the moment that the hand comes out and that it was just the female anatomy, we were kind of like, okay, this is cultural censorship. This is, yeah. You know, this is not about a rating at a certain point.
But. Yeah.
Did you take any pride in getting slapped with this NC-17 at first?
I'm a horror director.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Because I feel like that would be my reaction. I'd be like,
sad
well,
when it went.
I was like, be like, hell yeah. Then I would be annoyed that they wouldn't just come out and tell me, playing this like warmer, colder thing, yeah. trying to narrow down what exactly pissed them off. I would be annoyed by. But initially, my response would be to be very,
as a director,
very proud.
You're thrilled and you want to market that moment, you know, for the rest of your life. And then as like a female human, I was really depressed and hurt.
Yeah.
Cause I think back like to the days of when I was kind of coming into this thing, like the censorship was insane. And I'd always just assumed that things had gotten better. Cause I'd heard so many people were saying like, oh, it's much easier to get an R rating. Now they weren't counting F bombs as much and all this stuff. But like, I never even once considered how frustrating it would be. Like, yeah, we're not counting F bombs this time. And we're not going to give you notes on what you need to cut out of your movie. But how much more frustrating that could be if you find yourself in that situation. That's insane to me. Because then it seems like what that could lead to is that you would overcut, you know, the movie going, well, I don't know what it is, so let's cut this F word out here. Let's cut this moment of intention here. Let's cut, you know, this vagina here. You know what I mean? It's like it feels like that's a system that would lead to more things being cut than maybe even back in the bad days of the censorship.
But I think that's intentional, right? Is that if you're vague, then and somebody has to fish around on their own, then they're going to be self-censoring and it makes it easier for you. But I think also in going back, you know, just to the idea of having a female POV in horror, is that what is offensive is very different to a woman than what it is to a man, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think because we are so programmed to be kind of imbibing male horror, just inherently a vagina is going to be grotesque, you know, because that's what we've been told just through, you know, our self-programming of watching horror films. Mm-hmm. So I think like this, the interaction with the ratings board actually just made me realize like, oh, it's not just fun to be a woman in horror. It's actually really important because we're demonizing just the female form through these very like seemingly benign processes that we just accept as totally normal and part of the process.
Right.
Which is actually, and those things are really degrading and really offensive.
Well, we want to remind everyone to go check out The First Omen at your earliest convenience. And again, that's being released digitally on May 28th, hits Hulu on May 30th, and DVD and Blu-ray on July 30th. Congratulations to you guys on this movie. Like, you really killed it. And it must have been so awesome when this went from being like a Hulu release exclusively to go into theaters and then for it to roll out and be as successful as it was. I'm sure that feels great. So
yeah, it's been cool.
Congratulations on all of
that. Thank you so much. Yeah. Thanks for chatting to us.
Many thanks to Nell Tiger Free and Arkasha Stevenson for joining us. It was a little bit of a shorter episode, and little spoiler alert, we got a kind of a shorter episode heading your way next week, but we didn't want to pass up the opportunity to talk to Nell and Arkasha. We both were big fans of what they did with The First Omen, and we're kind of shocked at how good that movie turned out to be. And I'm glad that we had them on. I'm glad that they both had their own King thing to talk about, which, as you could tell listening to it, wasn't something that they had discussed with us prior to coming on the show. But I think we rolled with it pretty well, and we got to talk about both Tim Curry's performance as Pennywise and also a little bit about Carrie White. So that was
I agree.
A nice twofer.
You know, good times. Very sharp ladies. Delighted to have them on the show.
Yeah, for sure. And next week, we haven't recorded this yet, so it's very possible this could we could get kicked to the curb and told to pack up and go home. But right now, we are scheduled for to talk at the end of this week with none other than Ishana Shyamalan, who has a new movie out called The Watchers next week, and it is produced by her father, M. Night Shyamalan. and she is kind of an up-and-coming voice in the horror world. And we're both excited to see the movie and to talk with her. And this is going to be part of she's coming through town to show the movie. We're going to like do this yes. KingCast episode with her in person, you know, instead of over the internets like the hermits we are. So it's going to be an interesting experiment, but they were able to find some time for us on the junket day. So we're going to get a little bit of time with her. It'll be significant. It'll be like at least half an hour, but it's, you know, I know you guys are used to the hour long shows. It won't be you know, our default, obviously going forward, but they're, you know, both with the First Omen ladies and with Ashana, they were just two groups of people we didn't want to turn down the opportunity to have on the show. But yeah, we're really excited to talk with Ashana. I'm really excited to see the movie. We're seeing that on Thursday and talking to her on Friday. So now if something comes up,
I've loved all the trailers for this movie, and I am a huge M. Night Shyamalan fan. So I'm delighted to see like one of his kids stepping up and doing a feature, and that it looks to have some of that Shyamalan magic.
Yeah, it's pulpy. It looks pulpy. It looks fun. There's obviously big mysteries to be solved. You know, we're hoping that Ashana is going to be the Joe Hill to M. Night's Stephen King, and if that turns out to be true, then that's only good for all horror fans everywhere.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you want to tell the people what we got going on the Patreon this Friday?
Yeah, this Friday on the Patreon, we're gonna have a catch up episode with Vespi and I. We're gonna be talking about I don't know what we've been watching lately, what we've been reading lately, including Stephen King's "You Like It Darker." Yeah, we're doing a catch up episode. What have we been ingesting lately, Vespi? And I think that we have some recommendations to make. No?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what these inevitably turn into. Cause, it's very rare that we're like, and then I watched this thing and it fucking sucked, you know? And then I saw this thing that I really loved as a kid. I watch it again and man, I don't recommend it. It's usually like, oh no, this holds up, or it's really cool. Or listen, this is my favorite story in the new Stephen King compilation, you know, that kind of thing. We'll be going over that. We won't do a full-throated review of You Like It Darker just yet. We'll want to bring in a guest for that one, I think. But I can sneak preview tell you that I've spent most of the holiday weekend just going like crazy through that short story collection and burning right through it. So,
I think there is one particular story in there that we definitely want to talk about on the air.
Oh, yeah. So we'll get all that and more. You'll find out what's going on in all our lives as the dreaded Austin summer is kicking in the high gear.
It's awful.
It's
so bad.
We've already hit our triple digits a couple of times.
9 a.m. I hate it. I'm done.
For people who live in Texas, it always feels like we shouldn't be surprised by the terrible weather that we have to endure over the summer. But damn if it isn't every single fucking year.
Year.
But we'll talk about all that and more. Go ahead and head over to patreon.com/thekingcast and sign up. Throw us a few bucks and you'll get instant access to Discord. You'll get instant access to commentaries, interviews, random mumblings, mailbags, all that kind of stuff. You'll get your money's worth is what we're saying. We know that it's asking a lot to sign up for yet another little monthly subscription. So we do everything we can to make it worth your while. I think it's about time to mosey on down the road, the dirt trail. So we'll see y'all next week with our chat with Ashana Shyamalan and hopefully the influence of King on her work. And this Friday on the Patreon, we'll be catching up on all the media we've been consuming lately. And it'll be a good time. So look forward to having those chats.
Indeed. Adios, folks.
Bye. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.